Good evening. This is the KRFP Evening Report for Monday, July 7th, 2014. I'm Lee Robartis in the news tonight. Pullman superintendent says Initiative 1351 would mean at least 12 more K through 12 classrooms in the district. One recreational pot shop set to open in Spokane tomorrow. Montana Rail Link derailment spills Boeing fuselages into Clark Fork River. And U.S. Fish and Wildlife Agency tells biologists to reverse recommendations that wolverines should be classified as threatened in the lower 48. We'll have details on those stories and more coming up on the KRFP Evening Report. And live in the KRFP studios in Moscow, Idaho, I'm Lee Robartis, and this is the KRFP Evening Report. Pullman School District Superintendent Paul Sturm says the district will need more than a dozen more classrooms if Washington Initiative 1351 is approved by voters in November. I-1351 requires the state to provide funding to reduce K through 12 class sizes. Last Wednesday, supporters turned in 325,000 voter signatures to the Secretary of State's office in Olympia, which is more than enough to put the measure on the ballot. Sturm told the Daily News the school district is ready to build more classrooms and is already funding 10 to 15 more teachers' positions than required by the state through local levies. Passage of Initiative 1351 would mean even more classrooms and teachers than that. Washington ranks 47th nationwide in class sizes, with an average of 25 students in grades K through 3 classes, 27 in grades 4 through 6 classes, and 29 students in the average class grade 7 and above. Amid pot shortages, only one recreational cannabis store will likely open tomorrow in Spokane, the first day licensed stores are allowed to open in the state. The Washington Liquor Control Board issued the first 24 cannabis store licenses today, and three of those getting licenses the first day are located in Spokane. The Liquor Control Board says it will issue more cannabis retail licenses in the coming weeks. Only the recreational cannabis growers who received the earlier licenses before May have grown a crop to supply the stores. The Spokesman Review website quotes an owner of Spokane Greenleaf at 9107 North Country Homes Boulevard, saying the store received word a cannabis processor they were dealing with canceled a planned shipment to them, so they likely will have what they call a soft opening tomorrow and then have a grand opening over the weekend. Two other cannabis stores receiving licenses today in Spokane will open later this summer, likely competing with other stores in the Spokane area receiving licenses later. Justin Wilson, who owns Satori, which will be next to the long-running Peace of Mind glass and accessory shop he owns on North Division Street, says he will likely start to sell pot at Satori next week. The paper quotes Sam Calvert of Green Star Cannabis, also on North Division, saying he always planned to open in late July and possibly early August, even though he now has a license. All legalized recreational marijuana must go through an elaborate state barcode system, tracking the plants and bags from farm to sale. The strains also must be tested by a state-certified lab. Because of the small harvest so far and the high excise taxes, legal recreational cannabis is expected to cost $20 a gram, about twice as much as medical cannabis in Washington. Washington's medical marijuana system operates under a separate, more lenient set of laws when it comes to manufacture and distribution. The imminent owners of Pullman recreational cannabis licenses don't plan to open until later in the summer on Bishop Boulevard, and the city of Clarkston has a moratorium on pot retail still in effect. The State Liquor Control Board says it will issue a maximum of 334 store licenses statewide and authorize a maximum of 2 million square feet of cannabis growing area in the state. As of last week, the board had approved 62 pot-growing licenses. Although the Liquor Control Board says much of the delay is due to applicants not being ready for state inspections, some growers say they are still waiting for their facilities to get inspected. The state has yet to authorize any edible cannabis products, but the Liquor Control Board says that is part of their plan. The state will require those products be sold with extra labeling referring to dosage amount. Recreational cannabis is legal in Washington for those over 21 years old, although a person can only possess up to an ounce at a time. A newly appointed Idaho Wheat Commission member from Genesee believes it's only a matter of time before Monsanto's next big goal of genetically modified wheat on the market becomes reality. Farmer Joseph R. Anderson said the reason is because it will be necessary to feed the planet. Anderson, who recently served a 5-year term on the Idaho Grain Producers Association board, told the Lewiston Tribune, "We believe it's coming someday. We believe it's necessary to feed the planet, but it needs to come at a measured pace with consumer acceptance." Meanwhile, the Wheat Commission has pledged using $640,000 of its 3.5 cent per bushel assessment on wheat to fund a University of Idaho research position focusing on conventional non-GMO breeding research. Anderson said part of the goal of the research will be to cut the number of years between discovery of a new variety and on-the-ground production. Anderson said it would be important if we had to breed against disease. We would be way more responsive in getting a resistant variety out. Nevada Sheriff Doug Gillespie of Clark County told the Las Vegas Review-Journal he agrees with the Bureau of Land Management that rancher Clive Bundy, who lives in Clark County, needs to be held accountable for the April standoff between the rancher's armed supporters and federal agents. Gillespie said Bundy stepped over the line when he allowed militia members on his property to aim guns at police. Gillespie said, "If you step over that line, there are consequences to those actions, and I believe they stepped over that line. No doubt about it, they need to be held accountable for it." Federal agents were removing Bundy's cattle that were grazing illegally on federal land. The BLM says Bundy owes more than $1 million in unpaid grazing fees and penalties racked up over two decades. Bureau of Land Management spokesperson Celia Boddington told the Associated Press the issue will be aggressively pursued through the legal system. Boddington said, "There is an ongoing investigation and we are working diligently to ensure that those who broke the law are held accountable." A regional director of the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service Thursday ordered federal biologists to withdraw their conclusion that the 300 wolverines living in the contiguous 48 states deserve to be listed as threatened under the Endangered Species Act. Agency director Dan Ash is expected to make a final determination on whether to protect wolverines by August 4th. The order came after state officials from Idaho, Montana, and Wyoming, the only three states besides Alaska where populations of wolverines live, strongly objected. In making their recommendation, the biologists said climate change will destroy much of the near Arctic habitat where wolverines live. Officials from the three states said they didn't think scientists could accurately measure future climate warming and its impact on wolverine behavior and habitat. They also questioned how much wolverines are dependent on deep spring snow for keeping young wolverines safe and thermally buffered. There's some evidence populations of wolverines have expanded slightly in recent years, but Fish and Wildlife Service biologists said that expansion would likely turn into contraction by the end of the century. According to the Los Angeles Times, Fish and Wildlife Agency Ecological Services Pacific Region Assistant Director Terry Raybout said scientists have documented climate change deaths in polar bears and other animals, but it's unlikely to document climate change deaths in wolverines because, quote, "due to the near impossibility of obtaining such information on this hard-to-study species." U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service Regional Director Noreen Walsh had praised the biologist's recommendation last year, but on Thursday ordered the reversal The Los Angeles Times obtained a document that quoted Walsh's reason as uncertainties, quote, about the degree to which we can reliably predict impacts to wolverine populations from climate change. Retired U.S. Forest Service biologist Jeff Copeland with the Wolverine Foundation said Walsh's order, quote, without any new scientific evidence, is a sign of strong political pressure from the states. Center for Biological Diversity Endangered Species Director Noah Greenwald said caving to political pressure from the states goes against repeated pledges by the Obama administration to let science rule the day when it comes to decisions about survival of our most endangered wildlife. The Spokane City Council has voted to ban the city from purchasing or using insecticides that contain neonicotinoids, a chemical which is devastating bee populations nationwide. City Council President Ben Stuckert told the Associated Press the ban will cover about 30% of the land within the city, including parks, streets, and rights-of-way. Last year, Eugene, Oregon became the first city in the U.S. to completely ban the use of neonicotinoids. The chemical is widely blamed for being a major contributor to bee colony collapse disorder. Montana's Attorney General Tim Fox has intervened on the side of the U.S. Department of Interior, which is being sued by Wild Earth Guardians over the U.S. Department of Interior's approval process for coal mines. Fox said if mining is stopped at the Spring Creek mine, it will cost the state millions of dollars in royalties and taxes. Wild Earth Guardians has filed three separate suits against the Interior Department for allegedly failing to get enough public involvement and failing to adequately consider pollution caused by coal mines in Colorado, New Mexico, and Montana. Jeremy Nichols of Wild Earth Guardians said the problem is not just limited to one mine in one state, it's happening frequently. The other lawsuits involve the San Juan coal mine in New Mexico and the Colowayo and Trapper mines in Colorado. An attorney for the National Mining Association said because coal mines around the nation have gone through the same Interior Department approval process, the lawsuits could affect them as well. Stephen Bell wrote in a court brief, if Wild Earth's request for relief is granted, the result would be devastating economic harm to coal miners, operators, and the entire industry that services coal production. A Montana rail link train carrying six fuselages for Boeing 737 airplanes derailed at about 4 p.m. Thursday, 10 miles west of Alberton. Three of the giant fuselages tumbled down a steep embankment into the Clark Fork River, and the other three were on cars that derailed but did not tumble into the river. In all, 19 cars on the westbound train derailed. 13 of the derailed cars were carrying various types of freight, including soybeans and denatured alcohol. Montana RailLink spokesperson Linda Frost said the alcohol did not leak and none of the soybeans spilled. There were no injuries. Frost told the Missoula newspaper crews began trying to pull the fuselages and train cars up the embankment using eight pieces of heavy machinery and cables yesterday morning. She said that part of the job will likely continue into tomorrow. Boeing spokesperson Lynn Steinberg said the fuselages and other airplane parts were being transported on the train between Boeing assembly plants in Wichita, Kansas and Renton, Washington. In a separate derailment, Burlington Northern Santa Fe Railway says 10 freight cars derailed at a switching yard on East Trent Avenue in Spokane at 1:30 a.m. yesterday. BNSF spokesperson Gus Malonis said five of the slow-moving cars tipped on their sides and there were no injuries and no release of hazardous materials. Colville National Forest officials last month finalized the South End Project, a plan to allow more legal off-road vehicle use on a wide swath of the forest between Chewila and Newport. The South End Project, which is about 200,000 acres, would eventually open a loop road for off-road vehicle users, barricade the most damaging user-created trails in the area, and move campsites away from streams. The plan will take 15 years to fully implement and cost about $750,000. The money will come from Forest Service timber sales, grants, and other sources. The plan comes after 6 years of negotiations. Lands Council Executive Director Mike Peterson in Spokane told the Spokesman Review, "There are great intentions by everyone, but the people violating the rules aren't sitting at the table. Our concern was we'd open this new loop route, and what if illegal routes were punched into that?" Conservation Northwest Associate David Heflick told the Spokesman Review he's also concerned about the Forest Service's assumption that more off-road vehicle access will translate into less illegal use. Heflick said, "Wherever there are concentrations of ATVs is where there is the most damage. The plan includes a one-year waiting period where a trail must show no signs of illegal use before it can be opened." A Lapway woman is in the hospital after allegedly fleeing a sheriff's deputy that was trying to pull her over Saturday night and then crashing through the door of a Lewiston Fire Department station, sending her to the hospital and damaging two ambulances that were parked inside the fire station. Emergency crews at the 13th Street Fire Station had to extricate 48-year-old Patricia Wilson of Lapway from her car, and she is in fair condition at St. Joseph Regional Medical Center with a severely broken leg. Interim Fire Chief Travis Michael Bust said the agency's main ambulance, costing $160,000, may have been totaled. Michael Bust said another ambulance had minor damage. A third ambulance at the station was used to transport Wilson to the hospital. Idaho State Police are investigating the case as a possible DUI. Workers at the Hanford Nuclear Reservation are ready to begin decontaminating the room where a worker received the largest dose of the radioactive element aramecium ever recorded. Aramecium is a byproduct of the plutonium production during the Cold War. The room has been sealed ever since August 30th, 1976, when a chemical reaction caused a glass glove box to explode in the face of Harold McCluskey, who was 64 at the time. McCluskey was handled with remote control and removed to an isolation tank. He remained in a decontamination facility for 5 months, and his bathwater and towels became nuclear waste. McCluskey lived 11 years after the accident, although he suffered severe complications throughout the remainder of his life. People also ostracized him out of fear of radiation, and the Department of Energy studied him extensively until he died. The so-called McCluskey Room is part of the plutonium finishing plant, and its cleanup is one of the larger challenges of the plant's deactivation and demolition, scheduled to be finished in 2 more years. You are listening to the KRFP Evening Report. This is KRFP Moscow Pullman. Dogs barking mixed with patriotic songs was a sound heard at the 4th of July Mutt Strut in Moscow's Friendship Square at midday on the 4th of July Friday. The event included a reading of the Declaration of Independence by Mayor Bill Lambert and former City Council member Linda Paul, as well as comments by Moscow City Council member Wayne Krause, who quoted from the writings of Pat Boone.
"What's Independence Day like today? Do most people you know actually make time to purposely celebrate our independence in a meaningful way? Even while we've been locked in a deadly combat on foreign soil, still involving hundreds and even thousands of our finest young men and women, what are they fighting for now? Is anything like what motivated our Revolutionary Army? Is it freedom from religion, the necessity to take under God out of our pledge, or even to do away with it altogether? Or is it still the impossible dream of a nation under God with unalienable rights endowed equally to all? Amongst these, life, liberty, and a pursuit of happiness."
That was Moscow City Council member Wayne Krause reading from the writings of singer Pat Boone. 18 costumed dogs and owners entered in the Mutt Strut, and after all 18 showed off for the crowd of about 200, Mayor Bill Lambert, who was tasked with declaring a winner, asked the top two applause-getting dogs and their owners out for a final round.
"Hold the applause. We'll go for Betsy and Roxy first for applause. Now, go ahead. We want that one. Okay, now let's go with Samson. Isn't that terrific? Well, we got a big dog and we got a little dog. The big dog happened to win on this, and guess what? The big dog's United States of America, folks. Samson is the overall winner. Betsy and Roxy is the second place winner.
That was Moscow Mayor Bill Lambert declaring a Great Dane named Samson the winner of the 4th of July Mutt Strut in Friendship Square in downtown Moscow Friday. The Moscow City Council will be asked to approve revisions to the Moscow Action Plan part of the Palouse Basin Aquifer Committee Management Plan tonight. Each major pumper participating in the Palouse Basin Aquifer Committee, including Pullman, Moscow, Washington State University, the University of Idaho, and Latah and Whitman counties, approved action plans in 1992. Since then, many of the projects in the action plans have been completed or the plans needed to be modified due to changed conditions. Some of the major elements of the new Moscow Action Plan include attempt to limit annual aquifer pumping increases to 1% of the pumping volume based on a 5-year moving average of the pumping starting in 1986, attempt to limit the accumulated total pumping to a targeted maximum of 125% of the 1981 to 1985 average, continue a conservation-based rate structure for single-family residential customers, promote programs to encourage conservation and sustainable water use by multifamily residential and commercial users, continue the formal conservation program, which includes actions such as offering free water conserving devices to customers, and consider adding a toilet replacement rebate program, continue membership in the Palouse Basin Aquifer Committee with funding for studies and research projects as authorized by the City Council, continue program to update failing consumer water meters, continue to participate in education programs, for example, through schools, bill stuffers, and cable TV, encourage water recycling at building permit levels for major water users, continue to make city wastewater treatment plant effluent available to the University of Idaho in accordance with the city's agreement with the university, continue 24-hour daily recordings of water levels and production, explore possible expansion of wastewater treatment plant effluent reuse, and continue examination of alternate water supply options as approved by the City Council. The Council is expected to vote on the new action plan tonight. Other agenda items for tonight's Moscow City Council meeting include adopting the 2012 International Fire Code with modifications and pre-authorizing the Pullman Moscow Regional Airport to accept a $1.86 million airport improvement program grant from the Department of Transportation's Federal Aviation Administration. The money from the grant would be used for purchasing snow removal equipment, building a temporary equipment shelter, and terminal ramp rehabilitation. The project will require $207,000 in matching funds, expected to come from the Washington Department of Transportation's Aviation Grant Program and the Idaho Transportation Department's Aviation Funding Program. Tonight's Moscow City Council meeting begins at 7 p.m. at City Hall. Well, that's it for the KRFP evening report for tonight. Taking a look at the weather from the National Weather Service, it will be clear tonight, low 52, sunny tomorrow, high 91. In fact, mostly clear conditions until next Monday with highs of 88 on Wednesday, 86 on Thursday, 90 on Friday, and 93 Saturday, Sunday, and Monday. Lows will be mainly in the mid-50s. Currently, fair skies, 88 degrees in Moscow. Thanks for tuning in to the KRFP Evening Report for tonight. If you want to help KRFP keep newscasts like this on the air, plus the newscast you hear during Morning Mix, the recordings of local events and the public affairs shows, plus the music and arts programming you hear every day on Radio Free Moscow, be sure to become a member of Radio Free Moscow. Memberships are $35 a year, $20 for students and low income. You can mail your memberships to Radio Free Moscow, 114 East 3rd Street, Moscow, Idaho, 83843. That's Radio Free Moscow, 114 East 3rd Street, Moscow, Idaho, 83843. Or you can go to the Radio Free Moscow website to find out more ways to help Radio Free Moscow. I'm Lee Robartis. Have a pleasant evening. This is KRFP, Moscow Pullman Community Radio for the Palouse at 90.3 on your FM dial. Keep listening. We got news and opinions from the West Side with Eat the Airwaves coming up, followed by Flashpoints, the daily investigative news magazine from Pacifica Radio. And that'll be followed by Climate Justice Forum at around 7:30. Stay tuned.